Perhaps, she thought, a neighbor is in distress. But when she saw the people with the gray and tragic faces standing at her threshold, looming out of the mist and fog, her knees buckled. They did not have to speak a word. She knew. She knew exactly what they had come to tell her. "Oh, my God," the old woman managed as she fell. Pitifully, she began to retch, throwing up the whiskey that had helped her find sleep the night before. Her son-in-law, John Hill, watched, but he did not reach down to pick her up. Although a doctor, he lacked the will at this terrible moment. One of the friends who had come with him, another physician, knelt to help Ma. He grasped her gently and lifted her and walked her to the living room. There she fell, breathing hard, onto the sofa. John Hill watched her for a few moments, then he took a tentative step toward the back bedroom where the old man was sleeping. Clearly he dreaded to make this short journey. It was not Ma's nature to command anyone, for she was a woman who lived an obedient step or two behind her husband and her daughter. Her world was their shadows and drawn blinds. But now she threw out her hand with an edict. "Don't wake Pa," she said urgently. "For God's sake, let him sleep. This is the last night he ever will." And they all sat and waited, fearfully, for Pa to wake and rise and hear the news. 2. He was a paradox, the old man, Pa. With one clenched fist rising in the direction of the beyond, he cursed God, for he had no tolerance for the foolishness of religion. Yet with the other, he touched, in wonder, one of his most beloved possessions, an ivory Madonna that Christian warriors had borne through the Crusades, her back smoothed and worn from the frightened kisses of those seeking divine blessing. With one breath, he scoffed at the notion of an afterlife. "An awful lot of SOBs sit on the front row of the church house," Pa often said. "And if I had to spend an eternity with them, you couldn't drag me into heaven with 6 mules. But with the next, he likely as not would tell of his fascination for the ancient royal houses of Egypt and his knowledge of their elaborate preparations for the journey to the other side. When Joan was tiny, she often sat in Pa's lap and heard him speak of Radames and Nefertiti and Tutankhamun. "They tell me that old King Tut was buried in a coffin that weighs 2,400 pounds and is pure solid gold." "Imagine that, Joni. Solid gold. We'll see it someday. You and me are going to see it all." Across the map of Egypt, marked his twin fingers, strong and gnarled from the rocks and earth of the fields he explored in search of oil, whisking father and daughter across the seas. Now, if you stood the man against the wall and measured him, he was, on surface viewing, the stereotypic model of the Texas oil creature, from the wide-brimmed felt hat down to the gleaming black Lincoln automobile he drove at hurtling speeds about the freeways of Houston, a cassette of Eddie Arnold's country melodies soothing him from the tape deck. A quail had slight chance if it flew past the sights of his shotgun, nor did many wide-mouthed bass swim on if they chanced to nibble at his line. His politics veered to the right of Calvin Coolidge, and liberal Democrats, to his thinking, were as dangerous as a snake in his swimming pool. He would not invite a black man to sit at his dinner table or even enter the house through the front door, but should one arrive with a load of earth to freshen his azalea beds, he might sit in the sun and talk for hours of children and creaking bones and browning blossoms, like a life of rich promise so suddenly going away. He began most every morning with several cups of strong, hot coffee and an hour or two of spirited talk with a table full of affluent cronies in assemblage at the Houston Club, a clatch of elderly men whose breast pockets might contain, side by side, the report of a new East Texas gas well, the photograph of a grandson, and the vial of digitalis. But there was more to Pa than gold and vinegar. There were secrets he kept from the others. He had faced a firing squad and been told that his life would be spared only if he could quote from memory great chunks of Longfellow and Keats and Shakespeare. Then he would walk away free and alive. He could read a little Greek and Latin and might hold his own in the company of scholars.